It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. I love restaurants. The first job that ever made me excited to show up for work was in a restaurant. The first job where it felt like all the people that mattered were standing right next to me was in a restaurant. And the first job that ever made me feel like I was really in over my head, like sort of in a good way, was in a restaurant. Now, I was never a chef, and I have total respect for what chefs do, but I've always felt that restaurants were much more than just the chef. They're the cooks, the dishwashers, the hosts, the servers, and they're the people who gather in them. So this week, our show is all about restaurants and their people. We'll start with Amy Thielen. She's the author of a memoir called Give a Girl a Knife that's about her path from rural northern Minnesota to high-end kitchens in New York and back again. So, to be clear, she hasn't cooked in a restaurant in almost 10 years, and she's careful to say that she doesn't think she represents what it's like to be a woman in the kitchen. But Amy writes about her restaurant experience with a generous and human touch, and I want to talk to her about that human side of kitchens. And how, as we hear more and more about the sexual harassment in the industry, well, how she feels about it now. Amy, it's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so there are lots of stories and books about life in restaurant kitchens, but, you know, most of them, I think, are about the blood and guts. They're about, you know, the life on the edge stuff. But there's a passage in your book that I want to talk to you about because I think it's about a side of that life that we don't hear much about. And there's this moment where you describe two of your fellow cooks. You're working in restaurants at the time in New York City, in like high-end, super high-level restaurants. And you and these other cooks are prepping, and these two cooks, they start talking about their girlfriends. And one of them starts talking about how he came home in the middle of the night from work, and she made him a sandwich, and recalling that seemed to make both of them want to cry. And it's such a tender moment. And it really made me feel like people really can find family in restaurant kitchens. So can you tell me what you found in your kitchen families?
Oh, definitely. There was a kinship. I mean, that moment is really about feeding others. And these two guys who spend their entire day, all of us did, we spend all of our days feeding, you know, it's the hospitality industry. So there is this like compulsion to feed and to give, you know, it's there. And then when they go home, somebody does that for them. So, you know, it's really powerful. I definitely bonded with so many of the people that I worked with over the years. That's what a kitchen is. It becomes very familial because you spend so much time together and it's a very informal atmosphere and it's an intense, you know, environment, and there's high stakes and you have to depend upon one another. So definitely there's a family feeling.
Yeah. But you left restaurant cooking years ago now.
It's been a long time. I mean, I'm really not a representative any longer of, you know, a woman chef or anything like that. I cooked for 10 years or more, but it's been, you know, probably 9 years since I was there. So 10 years probably. So
yeah. Again, the famous stories about restaurant kitchens are about that intensity that you talk about. And, you know, there are lots of ways to look at that, that camaraderie, that, you know, it's almost like if you play sports, that's a metaphor, your team sports, that's a metaphor you understand, right? It's like,
I just don't really like sports, but I really don't like sports. But I would say that sports is a good analogy, but I think that maybe theater is a better one.
Huh.
Because, you know, when you're working in a kitchen, nobody else can really play your part. Nobody else really knows your lines. And that's exactly why people, cooks, when they get sick, they don't call in sick. Because it's, you know, nobody knows your part, you know. So I think theater is actually a really good analogy.
Yeah, but there is this other side, right? And you described it just now as a really informal situation. And, you know, that's it's a situation where there is also a lot of hyper macho intensity, and there's a lot of transgressiveness, and in some cases, like, being transgressive for its own sake. A lot of it is about, like, hey, we are a pirate ship, so we're going to act like one, and being foul-mouthed. And as I think is becoming really, really clear in what we've been hearing in the media and reports about what, assault and sexual harassment and in the industry, there is a lot of sexism, and there's a lot of conversation about how that kind of environment feels fine for some people, but makes other people feel really threatened and unsafe. And in some cases are literally threatened and unsafe. And
yeah.
And it's, you know, more and more as these stories have come out, it's become clear to me as a man who hasn't had to deal with a lot of this stuff on a personal basis, that people, especially women, either end up just putting up with it and they think it's part of the job, or it finally drives them out. And you have this line that is a beautiful line, but I want to ask what it means. You say you saw a lot of things that gave you pause, but you didn't want to hit the pause button when you were there. Why not?
I mean, there's so much to respond to with what you just said, but I wanted to be a cook, and I liked the environment of cooking because it was informal and it wasn't an office. But yeah, the sexism was rampant and it was really upsetting. And I don't think there's a woman who ever worked in a kitchen who wasn't upset by it. I mean, there are women who, every woman took a different approach and tack to dealing with it, you know? Mm. I mean, some women would talk dirtier than the guys, you know? And eventually that was kind of what I did as well. And you know, to be fair, it's like I hear about these stories and I experienced plenty of sexual harassment, but I was never assaulted. It was never physical. It never got to the point for me that I had to, you know, consider taking legal action. And when I hear these stories, I feel a little bit of survivor's guilt. You know, it's like, wow, it wasn't that bad for me. And why wasn't it? I don't know. But I just want to say that, you know, a shout out to everybody who didn't have it as easy as I did. And that said, you know, there was plenty that I had to deal with and that women have to deal with in kitchens. It's kind of like you have an extra part-time job on top of your really, really intense and very difficult job. And that's dealing with the emotional fallout of being, you know, a woman and having to be a little resistance fighter, you know, to like get what you want, because the kitchen is it can be such a competitive environment. And there's almost like a toxic masculinity a lot of times in kitchens. And frankly, I don't think that's good for the guys either. It's not good for the women. It's not good for the men. And I also think that a lot of men kind of sense that and know that, and that's not really what they want either.
Hmm. Tell me more about that. Why in your mind is it not good for the guys either, as you put it?
Well, okay, so the brigade system, Escoffier, you know, began the brigade system back in France, and we have to go back all the way to this to really kind of explain it, but, you know, the system of learning how to be a cook in Europe was always apprenticeship.
Sure.
And then at some point, from what I've read, you know, those apprenticeships were on site, and then the sleeping arrangements were kind of communal, so it was just like no women allowed. And so at that point going forward, it was just like this very male environment. And the apprenticeships, they start very young, like 13, 14 years old. And so you've got this like delayed adolescence at play, you know, in addition to an extremely high volume, high energy, intense, exhausting, long hours kind of job. So you've got that competitiveness and then you have, you know, kind of an eighth grade sensibility. And bringing those two things together just results in this like, ugh, you know, it's kind of really, it doesn't, I like banter. I like, you know, a joke. I even like bawdiness. And a lot of women who are in the kitchen do. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that when it crosses this line into this kind of like power dynamic that's like sexual, or, you know, when somebody says something that makes me have to think about their lonely parts, you know, that's completely out of line. I don't care what industry you're in.
Yeah. I mean, this is like a dumb analogy, but it's almost like there's a weird, weird dynamic in restaurant kitchens in the chef world where in some ways you have to feel like you're a warrior and in some ways you have to feel like you're a poet. Right. And
yes.
And the culture of that that violent culture makes it so, you know, it's sort of ultimately like people are like dehumanizing themselves. And like that's why it's also easy to dehumanize other people that you work with and treat them terribly.
Right. Yes, you're right. And, it, you know, and that kind of talk just really demeans the industry all around, you know.
Yeah.
And you know what it is exactly like? I have chickens, you know, now. and I look out the window and I see it happening in my roosters, you know. I mean, they're performing. It's bravado. They're crowing. It's this kind of, you know, this thing. And but that said, you know, I was given a lot of opportunity by a lot of the chefs that I work for. So I was able to rise up really pretty quickly, and I was given a lot. So I also have to say that. I mean, I think that a lot of women do extremely well in cooking. And, you know, the qualities that are needed to make a chef a great cook are not gendered whatsoever. You know, actually, I actually kind of wrote them down. I mean, it's like level-headedness and unflappability and good communication skills and a good palate and, you know, hard work and sensitivity. I mean, all these things are just, they're not gendered. There's absolutely no reason that men have had, you know, a run on the industry for as long as they have.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking with us, Amy.
Happy to.
Amy Phelan is the author of Give a Girl a Knife. So, over the past few months, there have been lots of news stories about the widespread issue of sexual harassment and assault in restaurants. And I'm hopeful that this will start an industry-changing conversation. It's one, frankly, that many professionals, mostly women, have been having for years while seeing it fall on mostly deaf male ears. But the work culture of restaurants can be such a complicated thing to talk about. In a lot of places, it's a culture where there's a lot of gray area in terms of what's acceptable. I've heard, and frankly said, things in a kitchen that I would literally never think about saying in a publishing meeting, for instance. And we said things that were out of line precisely because we thought, like 13-year-olds, that, you know, it's fun to say things that you're not supposed to say. Hey, it's all right, you know, because we're a team, and we all knew where we stood. Truthfully, things can get messy when you start blurring the line between what's okay and what's not. When "I'm just kidding" can either be a real apology or an excuse for making people feel uncomfortable and threatened. And now when I look back on it, as much fun as we were having, I can totally see why that environment could easily turn into one where people feel entitled to act truly terribly. And it's even more complicated when some of that bad behavior is deemed okay by the people affected by it. Like, I remember one chef I worked under who thought I was an idiot, and he was never shy about letting me know. Now, he never actually harassed me, but he definitely scared me, and I hate to say it, but I thought he made me a better cook that way. And eventually, I thought of him as a good guy in spite of, and maybe because of, the fact that he made me feel terrible about myself. Now, again, I'm a man. And like Amy and I were kind of talking about, I've had the privilege of never having to think about whether any of those taunts were because of my sex. I didn't have to do the emotional work of having to fit into a boys' club. And I've never had to walk home from work late at night looking over my shoulder, and just in general having to live in a reality where I had to be wondering if I'm going to be targeted. So I've always had the freedom to think of that chef's put-downs as just tough love. And I could well have spent the rest of my life saying, yeah, being a jerk works, and if you don't like it, find another job. And the people who survive in that atmosphere, who thrive in it even, well, is it any surprise that they might think that's the right way to treat the people under them? But I don't know. I mean, I think as the restaurant industry keeps growing in cachet, the expectation of professionalism is growing too. And what is becoming clear is, if you burn too hot, you might not burn for long. Coming up, we'll have a conversation with a woman who's trying to help people in the restaurant industry take better emotional care of themselves and the people they work with. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. Kat Kinsman, on top of having one of the finer names anyone's ever been able to call their own, has been writing about food for over a decade. But in her other life, she writes about something else, living with mental illness. And a few years ago, while she was interviewing chefs, she began to notice how much anxiety and depression came up in conversation. So she's trying to do something about it. So hey, Kat, thanks so much for coming in today.
Oh, Francis, thank you for having me.
You started a website and a Facebook discussion group called Chefs with Issues. What's it about?
It is about addressing the very previously under-discussed crisis of mental health in the restaurant industry.
And what compelled you to start it?
I am pretty public about my own struggles with mental health. I had a few essays that went viral when I worked at CNN about my struggles with anxiety and depression. You know, I'm also a food journalist. So what would happen is that I would be interviewing a chef. We'd be talking about whatever dish they were working on or their new restaurant. And there would come a break in that where we would change batteries from the recorder, somehow go off the record. And they would say, hey, here's what's going on with me. Here's what's going on with somebody in my kitchen. And it started happening more often than not. And I thought, you know what? No one's really talking about this. I know what it's like to just live in your own little bubble of despair, thinking you're a freak, and how talking about it can change things so radically. So on January 1st of 2016, I put up a website, just kind of a little signpost out there in the wilderness saying, hey, me too, if you want to come talk about it.
Yeah. And what have you heard?
Well,
I know it's confidential, a lot of what goes on.
Yeah, so I can't really talk about a lot of the specifics. But I put up a poll that day asking people. I just wanted to make sure that I was flinging this in the right direction. So I asked people what they were up against, specifically people who work in restaurants, whether it's back of house, front of house, the office, even, you know, PR people, writers, what they were struggling with, if they felt safe talking about it at work, if they've gotten any help. I thought I would get a few dozen responses. And last I checked, there were over 2,000 responses. Wow. To this survey. And they really are just suffering in silence. And the toll is tremendous and under-discussed, you know, from substance abuse to breakup of families to a lot of chefs taking their own lives. And, you know, it just, you figure if there's somebody probably statistically in the same room as you who is going through the same thing, if you can share that burden a little bit, things will get better.
You know, it's a weird industry, right? It's really intense. It's really hard work. Is there something specific to this industry where it makes it harder for people to ask for help? Do you see people talking about that?
Well, I'm going to break that down just a little bit, if that's okay.
Yeah.
People ask me, okay, there are all these other really tough, intense professions. There's athletes and, you know, and doctors and people in finance, and they're up against, you know, that much pressure as well. You know, what makes being a cook any different? They all have money. People in restaurants don't have any money or insurance. Mm-hmm. So people who work in kitchens are working for minimum wage, or if you work for tips, you work for a tipped minimum wage. You just don't have all of those resources that somebody in another profession might. So what happens is that a lot of people who maybe don't necessarily fit into a day-to-day office job or some sort of other profession, maybe don't have a, you know, super stable family life, or just for some reason don't happen to fit into that mainstream, find a home in the kitchen. It's a really great, fantastic thing. That's where you find camaraderie and family. And I've heard from, say, people who have OCD or something, that kitchen life really, really is great for that, because you're rewarded for the thing that you're good at, you know, order and repetition. And, you know, all of these other things that might be difficult in another kind of job make you a really fantastic kitchen worker. People thrive on the structure of it. They thrive on that really you know, intense atmosphere, and they're rewarded for, you know, all of these things that maybe in regular society make it a little bit tough for them. The flip side of that is that if you're, you know, somebody with a predilection to, you know, addiction or, you know, behaviors that are fueled negatively by that kind of atmosphere, you're going to find that exacerbated too. Even people who maybe don't have a predilection toward that, get caught up in the rhythm of it. They find the camaraderie. It's hard to come down emotionally, physically, after a really intense service. And it just becomes this cycle that it's really difficult to stand up and break because you're afraid that somebody is just going to tell you, that's how it is. That's how it's always been. You need to earn your bones. This is what toughness looks like. This is what being a cook looks like. I think this is starting to change.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you have a place where people at least start to talk about it and to hopefully get help with one another.
The really generous, amazing thing that I have seen is chefs usually aren't really great about taking care of themselves. They're all about in the service of the customer. And like you said, there's this incredible disparity toward the care they take to their guests. And dear God, you see all those sort of luminous videos of people delicately putting a microgreen on a plate on top of a perfect dish. They're showing more care to the microgreen than they are to the people next to them, or more importantly, to themselves. But if they are told, hey, you know what would be really great is if you can lavish some of this care on somebody in the same industry, given a chance and a safe place to do it where they won't be judged, they are so generous with helping each other out.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Kat.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kat Kinsman is the author of High Anxiety, Life with a Bad Case of Nerves, and is the founder of the website Chefs with Issues. America's Test Kitchen joins us here every week, and this week, in the spirit of our restaurant theme show, they wanted to get a little chefy and share a delicious, pretty geeky, but totally easy trick to salt cure egg yolks. And our producer, Sally Swift, got into it with ATK's Molly Birnbaum.
Hey Molly, good to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me, great to be here.
So we have been talking about restaurant-y things all day, and I am wondering, is there an idea or a food or something that you have discovered from the professional kitchen that is particularly easy and delicious for us home cooks to be taking on? Show our chefy edges to people?
Totally. I have just the thing.
I knew there was going to be an answer.
Well, I think that one thing that chefs do very well is turn everyday ingredients into something really special. I think some people assume to be a great home cook, you need to do like a crown roast of pork or add truffles to make something super memorable. Totally don't. One of my favorite things that we have done at America's Test Kitchen is developed a recipe for salt-cured egg yolks. It sounds fancy, but it is super simple.
Okay, so talk us through this.
Okay. You take egg yolks, you pack them in salt and sugar.
You're talking about a raw egg yolk here.
Exactly. You're taking an egg, cracking it, separating out the whites, taking the raw egg yolk, and then putting it in basically a bed of salt and sugar. Mm-hmm. So each yolk sits by itself in a little kind of hole that you create for it in this bed of salt and sugar. Cover it with more salt and sugar so they're completely buried. Cover it in plastic wrap and stick it in the fridge for 6 to 7 days.
It's like burying a kid at the beach.
It's exactly like burying a kid at the beach.
So what kind of salt? Just regular salt?
So we call for kosher salt, 1 pound of kosher salt and 1 pound of sugar. And then we blend it up before putting it in the cake pan where we put the eggs in to cure. And that's simply to make sure all of the particle sizes are the same, which helps with an even curing process.
You mean you grind them up like in a food processor?
Exactly. Or a blender will also work.
Okay, so you make little indentations for the eggs.
You do, which you can do with whole eggs. So you can take a whole, before you crack it, take a whole egg and stick it lightly into the salt and sugar mix to make little divots, which is where you'll then put the yolks to cure.
Okay, so they basically brine in that, right, in the refrigerator. How long do they stay in the fridge?
Right, you're curing them in the fridge for 6 to 7 days. Okay. And then when they're done, you take them out, you wash off the excess salt and sugar from the outside, and the texture has changed significantly. These eggs lose about 50% of their weight from water, which is pulled out by the salt and sugar. So they're firm and a little bit hard. So after you wash off the excess salt and sugar. You dry them out a little bit more in the oven at 200 degrees for about a half an hour. And then you have this delicious, bright yellow cured yolk.
Oh my God, how exciting. Okay, so what do we do with them?
You use them almost like you would a hard cheese. You grate them over pasta, over rice, over buttered toast. They add a really nice, nutty, kind of deeply umami flavor. And they're bright yellow, so it's a great visual pop.
And how long do they last?
You can keep them in the fridge for about 2 weeks.
And do you do a bunch of them at once? Would you do a dozen or would you just do a couple?
You can do it however many you want. Our recipe calls for 12 eggs, so 12 yolks.
This sounds like it has the potential to be a great hostess gift, right? Who would expect a cured egg yolk?
It does. That's the beauty of this recipe, is it's such a simple ingredient. It's incredibly easy to make, but it is surprising and delicious and starts a lot of great conversations.
Plus, it involves science.
Exactly. Even better.
Thank you, Molly.
Thank you.
Molly Birnbaum is the executive editor of Cook Science at America's Test Kitchen. You can find their recipe for salt-cured egg yolks at splendidtable.org. So we've been talking a lot this hour about the community within restaurants, but just as important is the bigger community that restaurants are a part of. Take the India Club, for example. It's this totally nondescript place in the center of London, two flights up from the street, but it turns out to be a vital center for the British Indian community, and it even played a role in India's fight for independence. And now, it's fighting for its own existence. Reporter Meera Sharma has the story.
On a bustling stretch of the Strand thoroughfare in central London, between elegant hotels and former palaces, there's a nondescript black sign that says, simply, India Restaurant, second floor. A creaky, dimly lit red staircase leads the way. And just when you think you're in the wrong place, a door appears. On the other side, light streams through huge bay windows and glints off pendant lamps. Diners surround tables laden with big bottles of Kingfisher beer and steaming bowls of curry. On the mustard yellow walls, there are oil paintings of Gandhi and other mid-century Indian political figures. Classic Hindi songs drift from a radio in the kitchen. This is the India Club. It opened in the early 1950s, and since then has remained basically frozen in time. Yadgar Marker manages the restaurant.
As you can see, everything is all 1940s and 50s. We haven't changed anything at all. The whole ambience of this place is of that particular period.
From the formica tables, so old they're trendy again, to the prices, astonishingly cheap for this part of town, to the food, a hodgepodge of dosas, biryanis, and regional stews, cooked just like the original chef did nearly 70 years ago.
So he passed on his recipe to the previous chef, and this chef has actually passed it on to my current chef. So the recipes and the dishes are still the same, they're just being passed on.
But what some call vintage, others might call shabby. The India Club, one of London's oldest Indian restaurants, may soon be no more. The landlords, a company called Marston Properties, recently applied for permission from the city council to revamp the place and potentially turn it into a boutique hotel. In response, Marker started an online petition entitled Save India Club. So far, it has nearly 17,000 signatures.
And we've been getting a very good response, a very positive response from the public. We knew that there have been people coming, but suddenly this has brought in a surge of people very keen to voice their opinion.
It's a familiar story in so many places. Beloved old haunts being replaced by shiny new ones, gentrification driving out the mom and pops. In London, which is full of slick Indian fusion restaurants and replicas of mid-century cafes, the India Club is refreshingly authentic. But the case for saving it is about more than just nostalgia. The restaurant has intersected with some of India and Britain's most dramatic history.
A big question mark has been written across the face of India. The Congress Party, led by the now-interned Gandhi and President Azad, made use of hooligans and agitators to press for a mass civil disobedience campaign. They professed passive resistance to the threatening invader.
The India Club has its roots in the India League, an organization led by V.K. Krishnamenon, who was a passionate campaigner for Indian independence.
When India becomes a sovereign democratic republic, I send my warmest greetings to all our countrymen abroad. In the long and eventful annals of our country, this day will have a special place.
I think he's probably most well known for being somebody who was really a thorn in the side of the British establishment.
William Gould is a professor of Indian history at the University of Leeds. He says that in the 1930s and 40s, Menon and the India League were crucial in galvanizing British public opinion against colonialism in India and lobbying the government for the cause.
He was, I think, described at one point in his career as the second most powerful man in India. He was very eloquent, articulate, very forceful personality, you know, somebody who was seen as something of a sort of problem for the British establishment.
August the 15th, 1947, Independence Day for India. In London, the flags of the new Indian Union flutter over the headquarters of India and Pakistan. An era has ended.
After independence, Menon was appointed India's first High Commissioner to the UK, essentially an ambassador. During that time, he opened the India Club to succeed the India League. Its co-founders included Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first Prime Minister, and Edwina Mountbatten, the last First Lady of colonial India. It was meant to be a gathering place for politicians, activists, intellectuals, a place that would, quote, cement Indo-British friendship and be a hub for Indian affairs in the UK.
It would be an act of vandalism, as far as I could see, if they were to destroy it. They can't.
Kusum Vadgama is an octogenarian optometrist who has been coming to the India Club since the 1950s, when she moved to London as a student.
I was out of place, without family, without a soul in this country. I didn't know anybody at all. And apart from going to college from Monday to Friday, what do you do over the weekend? There's no telephone, no television. Then I discovered that there was this India Club, and you could go there and eat there and meet other friends. So I went there, and I used to go there almost every Saturday.
But not just because it was a taste of home.
I was interested in history, and I was a freedom fighter myself, almost chucked out of the school because of my independent views about shouting at British and saying Jai Hind and all that. And to see some of these people that you read about in history books, and there they were, that excited me.
Over the last six decades, Kusum wrote for an Indian newspaper, attended lectures, learned traditional dance, organized campaigns around various diaspora affairs, all at the India Club. She says it isn't just a historical relic. It's still relevant today.
More than a symbol, it has been an active, pulsing heart of Indo-British relationship.
You know, the multiculturalism of London is represented by such places as the India Club.
Historian William Gould.
It's a pivotal part of our history in the UK. And I think, you know, particularly in the moment when there's quite a lot of imperial nostalgia and thinking about the effects of empire on the UK, given what's happening with Brexit, you know, I think it's quite important for us to sort of think about the influence that these post-colonial peoples have had on the UK.
In addition to the online petition, India Club manager Yadgar Marker and his team are asking customers to send in their memories of the restaurant to build an even stronger case for its public importance. They have also applied for the building to be listed as a historically important landmark. Of course, the club is on a street filled with far more expensive restaurants and hotels, and the allure of real estate may overtake history. Now, it's up to the local city council to decide its fate.
It should be done on a basis of understanding between the two parts.
Kusum Vadgama.
I don't want to have a quarrel. I don't want to fight because, you know, we are friends. You know, just let us be there. We are not doing any harm. The irony of it is we fought the British for 200 years and now they are fighting for us to get out of India Club. That's not fair. So I just feel that, look, we put up with you for 200 years. Can't you do that for another 200 years?
Meera Sharma produces The 85%, a podcast about the changing global order. And we have a recipe for you from the great Indian cook, Madhur Jaffrey. Find her orange and radish salad on our website, splendidtable.org. And coming up, I get to talk with you. And we'll take a moment to remember a great barbecue pitmaster. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. All right, let's talk, you and me. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or pick up that phone, 1-800-537-5252. We always want to know what you're thinking about. So we have Jill from Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jill, how are you?
Hi, Francis. Good. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. What should we talk about there in the City of Roses?
Well, I wanted to talk about persimmons. So I receive a produce box weekly, and my most recent one had three or four beautiful persimmons in there, which I've actually never used. But it also had cilantro, pomegranate, red cabbage, and some squash. And I was thinking maybe making some type of winter salad.
Yeah, that's absolutely the makings of many terrific meals, or like one fantastic salad for sure. So with the persimmons, do you know what type they are?
The fuyu, or I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah, so I think those are the ones that you really want ripe.
They're kind of hard on the outside and really soft on the inside.
Yeah, great. So like you want them really, really ripe, because those are the ones that I think if you eat them when they're still hard, it'll be really not fun. They get super astringent. It feels like you shoved a bunch of cotton balls in your mouth and like it just dries out your mouth. It's really, really unpleasant. But when they are soft and when they are, and some persimmons you can eat, well, firm, almost like an apple. But those type, when they get soft, they're like super smushy, super, super smushy. And it's almost like eating like a jelly. You're like, you got to go over the sink or you got to go over a bowl and just kind of shove it in before it falls out. But you'll be really happy you did it.
And can you eat the peel?
I don't. And I don't know if you can. I guess I've always just been shown that you peel them. I've never really tried.
Okay. I was just wondering when you said you shove it in your mouth. I wasn't sure if you meant the whole thing.
Yeah. I would like slice it open or maybe like quarter it. And then you just kind of, I don't know. There might be a polite way to do it. I don't know the polite way to do it. No, just kind of like, rah. But I think if it's that kind where it's almost sort of meltingly ripe, you can incorporate that into your dressing. So with your cabbage, I would shred your cabbage nice and fine. Salt it pretty well. Mix it with your hands. You can even give it a little squeeze to sort of get it working. Okay. And what happens is the salt will start pulling out a lot of water in that cabbage. And it's almost like the salt will marinate the cabbage and the cabbage will like, the flavor will be like in 3D. It's really, really cool. So you can squeeze out the extra cabbage juice if you want or just leave it in there. So let your cabbage hang out. I would, with the squash, I mean, maybe I would go ahead and roast the squash, slice it thin and roast it, or maybe just slice it thin and saute it in a pan so it gets some nice browning.
Okay.
Or maybe like cut it into little cubes and brown it in a pan. And with your persimmon, I might go ahead and squeeze maybe not a whole one, but like a half a one. I mean, depending how much salad you're making or whatever, but squeeze some of it into a bowl and see if you can't mash it up so it's really nice and almost liquidy. Maybe whisk it to break it up or just go into a food processor and really just puree it up. And that flavor is super sweet and it's really beautiful, a little bit floral. To that, I would add some vinegar. I could see lots of different vinegars there, like an apple cider, a nice apple cider vinegar, or sherry vinegar would be beautiful in there, or even a rice vinegar. Really kind of depending on what you're just feeling like. You could do lemon juice for sure. And whir that up in your food processor, and then salt, a little bit of salt to start getting the balance going, and then pour in your oil. And for that, you can do like a, you know, just like a straight canola oil or really neutral oil, but finish with a little bit of nice nut oil, like a walnut oil. Or hazelnut oil, I think, would be so delicious. Or you can certainly just go ahead and use olive oil, you know, whatever you like. But that persimmon will bring so much sweetness to the vinaigrette that you're going to want to make sure you have enough acid to really sort of not let it be too sweet. You know what I mean? And then salt it really nicely, too. And I think that sounds like a great... Oh, and your pomegranates. Like, those pomegranates will add crunch and will add beautiful color. I think that sounds like a great, great salad.
Okay, wow, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, and with that, I might also do, if you have like parsley, just like a mm-hmm. nice fresh parsley, really okay. roughly chop it. I mean, like barely even chop it, like maybe one leaf becomes two halves, you know, that kind of chop. And toss okay. it in there too. Not only will it give it color, but it'll give it a beautiful grassy green flavor to go with that nice salted cabbage and that sweet okay. vinaigrette and the fruity persimmon. I think that sounds awesome.
Okay. Do you recommend a type of nut or cheese to add in there?
Anything, really. I mean, you're in Oregon, so hazelnuts are like, you know, they're like nothing else. I mean, a beautiful Oregon hazelnut is just a thing of beauty. I just said that a beautiful thing is a thing of beauty. I'm on the radio. but like, yeah, an Oregon hazelnut is terrific. Or walnuts, I think, sounds so good in there. You know, pecans. You know, one of the sweeter nuts, I think, would be
okay.
awesome in there. Yeah, that's a great, great call. And it'll give you some richness okay. and body, too. And cheese, I mean, with those flavors, I mean, I think a nice cheddar, like a nice aged sharp cheddar could be really good.
Okay. Just like shaved in there.
Yeah, you know, okay. a nice grated cheddar. And not so much that it takes it over, but again, gives it more richness and gives it a little more body.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, thank you. I will certainly try that.
Yeah, enjoy that.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Thanks so much for the call. And now we have Thomas from Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Thomas, how are you?
Hi, Francis. I'm doing great. So I had a question about marinara. So my wife and I were having a debate. We had grown a ton of yellow heirloom pear tomatoes, and you know, I was looking to use them, so I made a sauce, and I called it a marinara sauce: olive oil, garlic, 6 or 7 cups of yellow pear tomatoes that I blanched and removed the skin, and some nice fresh sage and salt and pepper. Cooked it up, and then was serving it over some spaghetti squash, and. So I was calling it marinara, and my wife, she said that was blasphemous. There's no way you can call this marinara. That marinara is only with red tomatoes. So I thought that maybe you guys could help us.
Oh, help settle the debate?
Help settle the debate, yes.
Oh, okay. So here's the thing. As I understand it, marinara actually refers to sailors, like marine, right? So it's already a weird name for a tomato sauce. And I think the explanation I heard a zillion years ago was that, you know, because it was acidic, they could make it and they could can it and they can bring it with them. I don't know if I buy that. But it was something about like preservation and storage.
Right.
And so that's why it referred to tomatoes, because you can, you know, they're acidic on their own. They can can pretty well. So I don't know that it has to be red. If we're going with that theory, which again, like I said, I don't know if it's true or not, it doesn't seem to me that they would have to be red. However, maybe the technical question is, are your yellow tomatoes acidic? Because a lot of yellow tomatoes are lower in acid.
That's a really good question. They are a little sweeter for sure.
So maybe your wife does win. I don't know. Can you just call it even?
Yeah, it's tough. You know, as a dish, you know, it was all yellow because we had the yellow sauce over yellow spaghetti squash. So that was a little weird. It was very delicious, but you know, not it wasn't that good contrast on the plate. But still delicious.
Then you're all winners. Everyone wins. And plus, I mean, I was totally with you throughout your description of the sauce. The fact that you blanched and peeled the tomatoes shows a high level of care and love. And I thought the sage was really cool. I don't really hear about sage and tomato sauce very often. So honestly, if I were there, I would say, hey, guys, this is an amazing dinner you've just made. Let's not fight anymore.
Yeah, let's call it a healthy debate.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, I'm sorry I don't have a definitive answer, but hopefully my half-brain logic got you to a place where at least you guys can call a truce.
No, we're all good. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the call, and that sauce sounded great.
All right. Have a good one, Francis.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That sauce sounded so cool. That dude, like, blanched and peeled 6 cups of tomatoes. Good for him. I would literally never do that. You know what I would do? I would throw them in a blender. That's what I do. That's like my hot new move with tomatoes is like, I'm just going to blend it. It is so smooth and beautiful when you do peel them, though. Again, our number, anytime we have voicemail, we are up to date on that kind of technology, is 1-800-537-5252. We're waiting to hear from you. When Douglas Oliver passed away in the fall of 2017, the food world lost someone special. And you've probably never heard of him. I know I hadn't. But for more than 30 years, Mr. Oliver cooked hogs in a small town in South Carolina and made people happy, whether or not they knew who he was. Hidden in the pits, working through the night, probably most of the customers never saw him, and it was like their succulent, smoky pork just came out of nowhere. But Douglas Oliver, like every cook, busser, server, or dishwasher in every restaurant, has a name. And we remember that name with this story by Ryan Fertel.
Restaurant kitchens are full of unsung heroes, obscurity toilers, invisible workers like Douglas Oliver, who died this past October. For over three decades, Douglas worked as a pitmaster at Sweatman's Barbecue in Holly Hill, South Carolina. He called himself a worker ant. His work was cooking whole hog barbecue. Back in 2012, he invited me to stay up all night and watch him labor. It was brutal, tedious work. Shoveling fresh coals under the hogs every 20 minutes from well before dusk to just after dawn. Peace and quiet kept him there, he told me. A place to think about the past and the future. A place to keep your head on straight.
My mama always told me, if you put something in it, you'll get something out of it. And it takes, we start on Tuesdays getting this thing ready for just the weekend. We gotta gather wood, get the stuff ready and everything, clean up and everything, and then on Fridays, Thursdays, and Friday we cook. So we're putting a lot in it. It's a lot of hours, a lot of man hours too. You know, that's for everybody, you know, even the boss. So it's going, you know, like I say, like Mr. Sweat, see the sign says, sweat a man? That's it.
Douglas was born on a neighboring plantation farm, the son of sharecroppers, the youngest of 13. He started at Sweatman's right out of high school. Back then, they cut their own trees for fuel. In 1989, he kept cooking as Hurricane Hugo toppled tree after tree surrounding the pit house. When a famous food personality stopped by with a film crew, he ignored Douglas. When the episode aired, a manager, who was white and had likely never cooked a hog in his entire life, was given credit for Oliver's work. Douglas calculated that he had cooked over 50,000 hogs throughout his life. Still, he refused to call himself a pit master. He was just a cook, he told me. That's it. Just a cook. Trying to do the right thing. Trying to cook something good. The barbecue in this part of South Carolina comes slathered in mustard sauce, golden in color. The sauce has never been my favorite, but on my first night with Douglas, he pinched a morsel of meat from the hog, still sizzling on the pit. As I wrote in my book, he held this piece upward, like a mother bird feeding her nestlings, like a prospector examining his discovery in the light, this pure golden nugget glowing in the dark pit house, and handed it over to me. It was the best single bite of barbecue I have ever eaten. Douglas had been sick for several years, his body racked inside and out from a life shoveling fire, inhaling smoke and grease. Douglas Oliver passed away on October 30th at the age of 56. He fed hundreds of thousands.
That Remembrance of Douglas Oliver is by Ryan Fertel. Ryan's the author of The One True Barbecue, Fire, Smoke, and the Pitmasters Who Cook the Whole Hog. And that's our show for the week. I hope you enjoyed our little mellow love song to the people of the restaurant world, and please join us again next week. And in the meantime, eat well, drink well, and tip well. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. If you'd like more on anything you heard here, go to splendidtable.org. Thank you for tuning in. Talk to you next week. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.